Good morning. Welcome to Wednesday of APHA. We're so glad you're still here. This session is on pain management and labor and its impact on breastfeeding. We have three fantastic presenters you're not going to want to miss. I'm Brianna Yeager, and I'm the chair of the breastfeeding committee for the MCH section. I have nothing to disclose, which I forgot to say earlier in the week, but it's still true today. And our first presenter is going to help set the stage for us on, you know, what are the mechanisms of lactogenesis and how pain management plays a role. So I would like to welcome to the stage Dr. Ann Dozier, who is a doctorally prepared nurse with over 30 years of experience in maternal and child health, including health services administration, evaluation, and research, including both qualitative and quantitative methods. She has had NIH and CDC-funded studies related to breastfeeding. She's also the chair-elect for MCH and serves as the APHA delegate to the U.S. Breastfeeding Committee. So we're very excited to have her with us.
So thank you all for coming. I feel like the airline. I know you have choices to fly today, and just thank you for choosing us. You know. I will try to set the stage, but not steal the thunder of the two other presenters today. And I appreciate Brianna's opportunity Brianna provided to me to talk a little bit about this topic. And I think while it's important that, you know, we want answers that are black and white, and unfortunately, very little about the human body across the biopsychosocial aspects of it is that clear cut. And further, we know that the mother herself is embedded in a complex physical, social, and political environment that further complicates our ability to understand, study, and intervene. And as we examine this critical transition period of lactogenesis, it's important to keep in mind what I call the 5,000-foot view. And for those of you who know me, you know that I rarely fail to mention the social ecological model, and today is no exception. Oh, and I have nothing to disclose either. So if we think about this in the context of all of these levels and understanding that they all need to be kind of mutually reinforcing for us to make progress, if we think about the policy level in the context of lactogenesis, we're thinking about the model hospital breastfeeding policies, and we're thinking about requirements to track indicators, for example, preterm or elective inductions. We think about the institutional level practices and training for things like interventions such as skin-to-skin or separation or non-separation of mother-baby dyads, or the timing of the infant's post-delivery bath and medications. Down to the community, what's in the norm? Are epidurals the norm? Is breastfeeding the norm? What about hospital visitation? Those of us who've been around for a long time remember when, you know, you didn't have, you know, a cast of thousands at the delivery and in the hospital, and family-centered care has become kind of community-centered care in some respects. And then down to the interpersonal levels and support during labor from family or friends or staff or doulas to the individual mother, and what are her intentions, her expectations, her knowledge, what's her experience, past experience with breastfeeding and labor and delivery. So these levels and circumstances both act independently and synergistically. Some are modifiable and some are not. The more we learn, the black and white disappears, and our world becomes more and more gray. So I'm going to go back to the base. Oh, excuse me. While today we're focusing on pharmacologic interventions during labor and delivery and their relationship to breastfeeding outcomes, what we must always keep in mind is that at that individual level, managing an individual mother may not fit the pattern or the data or all of our past experiences. Likelihoods and risks, rather than certainty, shape our world, and decision-making at that level becomes a complex balance of what we know may or may not work on one side with what we really don't yet fully understand. We're increasingly interested in these issues due to what I describe as a seismic shift in attitudes about labor management and intervention. While the medicalization of birth that occurred in the 1950s and 60s was pushed back against in the later 60s and 70s by women seeking natural childbirth, and the subsequent shift to VBACs, vaginal birth after cesarean, and freestanding birthing centers, and hospital birthing rooms, although some of that's probably a little more marketing than not, to the more recent movement, again mother-driven, to manage labor through use rather than avoidance of medical interventions. As a child of the 60s, I'm mystified. Of course, I'm also declaring my age. Mind you, many women now avoid all manner of exposures during pregnancy, tobacco, drugs, artificial ingredients, other medications, environmental exposures, and things like of that nature. But when labor begins, seemingly nothing is barred, including the scheduling of the delivery. While I will not wax philosophic about this irony, or how this desire to manage or control a situation extends to the mechanization of breastfeeding, today's presentations must take into account not only the medical concerns that may be the drivers of what happens during labor and delivery, but the complex social phenomena and context in which decisions not just about infant feeding, but about labor and interventions are made. Long-winded beginning. Sorry about that. So back to the basics. I thought it would be helpful for us to start with these relationships. So we have an exposure and an outcome. An exposure can be a policy, a practice, a condition, could be modifiable, might not be. We have an outcome, it could be short or long, something we anticipate or don't. And then there's a question of the arrow. Is there a cause and effect relationship there? So causality is has a number of requirements. It has to be temporally aligned, fancy word for it. The exposure has to happen before the outcome. Ideally, you'd like it to be some kind of dose response. You'd like it to be replicable. You'd like it to be plausible. Is it biologically plausible? Is it make some sense? And as we think and talk about some of these issues today, that is probably one of the more basic driving questions that remains to many extents unanswered. So now we talk about this fun thing called confounder. It can make it appear that relationship actually exists, that the big arrow actually may not have a causal relationship or any relationship, but the confounder may in fact explain it. And the confounder can be a positive or a negative in terms of enhancing or detracting from the exposure. It can be something we observe or that we don't observe, but that has a strong effect and distorts the magnitude of that relationship. Now we have something called moderator. It changes the strength or the effect of the relationship between these two variables. It indicates when or under what circumstances that could happen. And again, it affects the directionality and strength of that. And then you have something fun called a mediator. It's kind of on the causal pathway or thought to possibly be on the causal pathway. It plays a role in what they call in the relationship between those two variables. And I start with this basics because the diagrams of when we talk about lactogenesis are going to become increasingly complex, as you will see. So at the very basics today, we're talking about labor pain management and their relationship to breastfeeding outcomes. But the reality is that lactogenesis, which is the shift which occurs postpartum, in the part I'm going to focus on is the postpartum aspects of this, that where you move from an endocrine to an autocrine process to a supply and demand process, is actually probably a mediator between anything that goes on from the labor pain management as an exposure to breastfeeding outcomes. But maybe labor pain management, you'll see I've had to flip some of these because this slide's going to get busier and busier. But maybe labor pain management is more of a moderator. Maybe it moderates this relationship. And so I picked something that precedes the labor and delivery experience. It could be anything. I chose intention to breastfeed just as an example. So the woman wants to breastfeed. You know, for her to have a successful breastfeeding outcome, she needs to go through all the processes of lactogenesis. And to what extent does labor pain management and those interventions affect that process, affect lactogenesis? But maybe it doesn't just affect the mother's experience indirectly. Maybe it actually has a direct effect in the relationship to the mammary cells, you know, with that in terms of any impact that it has on oxytocin or on prolactin. Maybe it's a moderator too, or excuse me, mediator. You know, I don't know that, from my perspective, I don't think that this is exactly the a possibility. I think this has been raised as, you know, is it really on the causal pathway? I'm not particularly, you know, convinced personally that that's the case. But I do think labor management could be seen as a moderator. Excuse me, a mediator. This is where you get crazy. Thank goodness I'm not doing this at 6 o'clock at night. But labor management and all the things that we talk about with labor management could, in fact, be on the causal pathway and be an interference with the development of lactogenesis. Now, where do maternity practices fit in? Well, they could be a moderator. They could moderate this relationship between, and so when we think about maternity care practices, what do we think about? Skin to skin, early start, all things that, you know, have physiologic impacts. We also think about, you know, not separating the mother and the baby so that there's more opportunity for the baby to be put on the breast. So that could be a factor in affecting whether or the extent to which labor management affects lactogenesis. But maybe it's not on the causal pathway. Maybe these are just two, labor pain management and labor management, which I have purposely distinguished between. Because labor management can be what? Labor management can be elective sections, no labor at all. It can be an induction. It can be natural childbirth. All of which have kind of look different when you look at them through the lens of labor pain management. So I shifted this to look at, okay, maybe it isn't just that they have some moderating effect, but labor pain management may have a synergistic effect with labor management, and there is certainly some literature that looks at the combination of inductions and epidurals as working together in a very negative way to, you know, depress endogenous oxytocin, for example. And then you have maternity care practices. It's, again, part of the context. So to what extent do they, as I was talking about before, help to kind of overcome some of these barriers? And what's interesting is that some of the data on this synergy that I referred to, it looks like it is worse for, I'll put that in quotes, primips, women who have never had, whose breasts haven't been exposed, haven't been used for breastfeeding before, or women who are primips may have a greater sensitivity to this. And once you've been through and lived through the thrill of labor and delivery, that, you know, your body may not be as sensitive to some of this synergistic effect. Not clear, but you can get an appreciation for how complex it is. Because the other part is when we look at this, and this is still the same picture, I moved this down because maternity care practices may just not be moderators on their own. They may affect, or likely affect, how we think about and manage women's, what they get for pain, when they and how they get it. It may affect how we manage women's labor. It may affect lactogenesis directly, as well as breastfeeding outcomes. If you think about the full range of maternity practices that we have and how they permeate what we do within the hospital, but can have not only their separate effects, but influence in both a positive and or a negative way, these influences. Again, the diagram gets more complex. And the last piece is, where does the infant hang out with this? We've been talking about the mother. So what's going on with the infant, and to what extent is the infant either depressed or stimulated by the interventions? To what extent does the pain management affect how sleepy or not sleepy this infant is? To what extent does the infant's actions or inactions, depending on how well it is suckling at the breast, contribute to lactogenesis, contribute to the relationship that this mother is trying to establish with this baby in terms of them getting into sync, and if that doesn't go well, her frustration and kind of some of the cyclical processes that happen here. So this is just, I had tried to start this out simply because this is how I organize it. And I think it's important to think about how all these things work independently and synergistically, and I'm just going to walk briefly through these with a little more detail, but I want to point out a couple of aspects of this. is that not only do these, so we have the three stages of lactogenesis, but not only do you have the direct effects of the labor and delivery or those experiences in terms of interventions and support, the maternal characteristics in the infant, but you have their interactions here. And it's this synergy and this interaction that oftentimes the analyses that we are doing to look at the impact of pain medication, of labor management on these babies or on this mother-baby diet, we are not taking fully into effect or into account the synergy. We look at these as if they are discrete activities, discrete interventions, where in fact their interaction may further complicate or make better what the situation is. So just to re-clarify, we think about lactogenesis as potentially two or three stages, depending on who you read. But stage one, which occurs during the prenatal period, the differentiation occurs to secrete the milk, but it's held back by progesterone until delivery. Then you get stage two, which is the onset of copious milk secretion, which, of course, we know delayed lactogenesis or delayed stage two is one of the measures that we are interested in looking at. And then we have the maintenance of established milk secretion, which is stage three. And we measure this by a variety of different ways, from breast milk volume to measured by milk coming in, which is typically maternal report, or by biomarkers in the breast milk. So just to hit on some of those maternal factors and characteristics, I've mentioned a few of them, but we look at, the goals and their breastfeeding intention. We look at the mother's depression. We look at her stress, and to what extent does that play into the decisions about intervening during labor and delivery? To what extent does her health and her risk factors contribute to her decision-making, her care team's decision-making, and her added risk of going into a labor and delivery experience? What are the conditions of her breast and nipple? How well prepared, is she? And from a postpartum standpoint, what is her confidence? How edematous is she? How swollen is she? And this is this whole issue of some of the problems or the challenges with the interaction of epidurals and inductions is the amount of fluid some of these mothers get. And so the mother may be very, edematous. We're dealing with more obese women, so they already present some challenges. And if those women are, in fact, now overloaded with some fluid, having a successful latch becomes even more challenging for these infants. And I'll get to the infant in a minute. So the edematousness of the mother, how long she's in the hospital, and what are her various hormonal levels, and how have the medications that she's been given affected her prolactin and her oxytocin release. Then you have the maternity care environment. Again, what has happened to her? What analgesia or anesthesia has she gotten? How long was her labor? And then how exhausted she is in terms of fatigue as a part of that. What are the maternity care practices that have been put in place, and to what extent have they been implemented? And has that been affected by whether she had a C-section or whether she had a vaginal delivery? That, again, gets influenced by whether she had was induced, whether she had an epidural. And, it's so interesting, again, as I said, I'm a bit of a child of the 60s, and having, delivered with self-hypnosis in a, I didn't deliver in the whirlpool, but I've labored in a whirlpool, 9-pound baby, nothing. And to talk to women now who are choosing all manner of interventions, it just, as I said, mystifies me. But we look at what are the other things that we have for maternity care practices from skin to skin. How early is that baby put to the breast? How quickly are we to supplement? And are we promoting breastfeeding on demand? Now, granted, these are all the baby-friendly hospital practices, but they may or may not be being implemented. Even in baby-friendly hospitals, they may not be implemented as consistently as we'd like them to believe. We still have a level of stereotyping of women, the young black mother who comes in, we may, she's never going to do this, so we're not going to bother. And so, there's lots of other kind of issues that arise. I won't go into all of the different drugs administered during labor, but just wanted to mention that they are used for, both for induction and augmentation, prevention of postpartum hemorrhage and pain control, and they have varying effects on both the prostaglandin and oxytocin that are needed for successful lactogenesis. The other infant factors that I wanted to mention, because this is another place where the administration of fluids gets complicated, because the fluids given to the mother during labor, it's not like the baby is unaffected, and many babies are born and then have this pretty dramatic, can have this dramatic weight loss that isn't really weight loss, it's just that they're diuresing all these funky extra fluids that people get, but it's interpreted as weight loss. And so then you end up with the oh my goodness, we have this baby with the 7% weight loss, we need to supplement, which then, of course, they're no longer exclusive, which, you know, sets us down a path. But as with anything, once you start intervening, it's very hard to stop intervening from a standpoint of how the labor happens, and then it then spills over into the delivery and the postpartum periods. So again, there are other issues that complicate the complicate lactogenesis from the infant standpoint in terms of how awake they are, how well they are to our latch, how stressed or unstressed they are. And that some of that is from what has happened during labor and delivery and the medications the mother was given. And then at the far end, which is beyond this immediate postpartum piece, we have what happens at home and the support that the mother is going to be getting at home. So, but just to close, there are lots of different pathways that explain the relationship between maternal and infant factors and these institutional practices. And they all can be disrupted or delayed by interventions that happen during labor, or they can be supported through the early breastfeeding initiation, skin-to-skin, and a lot of the different hospital practices. So I hope I haven't stole the thunder or the things that my colleagues are going to be talking about and have at least adequately begun to get you thinking about the complexity of what we're talking about and how the challenges we have of trying to study and understand the very tiny slice of the pie that labor medications play in the broader role of lactogenesis and in the broader role of breastfeeding. It presents huge challenges to us as researchers and as clinicians and as we're trying to guide individual mothers and as we're trying to teach our students about how to balance what we know versus what we don't know and to have a successful and wonderful breastfeeding experience and experience for the mother. Thank you very much.